Hello, everyone. This is Robert Wood, the CEO of Sidekick Security. And today I am joined by Tyler Healy, the CISO of DigitalOcean. And I'm going to turn it over to him so as not to steal his thunder around his introduction. But today we're going to be talking about everything from security enablement and digital trust and kind of how you work that into a product setting. And I'm super excited about this. And so, Tyler, take it away, sir.
All right. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm the Chief Information Security Officer at DigitalOcean. We're a cloud infrastructure and platform as a service provider. I've actually been with DO for 6.5 years now. So when I started, it was still a bit of the Wild West startup days. And now we've gone through IPO to kind of our next arc and journey in enabling cloud for businesses and developers around the world. Before DO, spent some time in the federal and defense space, and then some time in the private sector consulting land, primarily focused on telecom technology and biotech businesses. So kind of crossed a bunch of different lands before getting to DO, and it's been an exciting journey helping to get DO to where it is today and building the security team, where we cover trust and safety, core security issues, privacy, enablement, and actually have started pulling some of the core IT and business systems as well into the security fold.
I love it. And before I jump into the meat of the topic, one of the things that I want to do with this podcast is interview and have a trade-off between public sector leadership and private sector leadership. I went through that journey. I started in startups, and then I did the whiplash thing and went into big government, and then I came out, and now, not in that anymore. And so for you, how do you feel like your background in consulting, which is, you kind of drink from the fire hose and see everything, going into public sector space, very regulated, very mission oriented, and out here, how do you feel like that has served you from a perspective or a leadership experience standpoint?
Yeah, definitely got a lot of different perspectives and saw a lot of things that I liked and a bunch of things that I didn't like as well in terms of how security teams operated. Certainly started to shy away from the heavily regulated spaces for sure. I mean, spent enough time with pharmas and learned enough about GXP and how that actually can sometimes negatively impact a security program, because once you've actually built something that's producing a drug or maybe it's a piece of technology or equipment that's been certified the numerous ways that you need to in order to be able to bring it to market, it can be incredibly difficult to change and incredibly expensive to change. And we know security is all about being able to change sometimes as quickly as possible. So you get these competing environments where the regulatory component of it, which is intended for safety, can sometimes make things even more unsafe, at least from a cybersecurity standpoint.
Right. It's compliant to the neglect of everything else, or that's the only one you can't see.
Yes. Yeah. And even in some of the security regimes, we see that too. I mean, the dozens of different ways that folks have to be compliant. I mean, I grew up in an era of the federal defense space with a lovely thing called Gold Disk. I don't know if that rings a bell for you at all, but just the entire process of compliance checkboxing your way through an operating system through multiple hundreds of controls. Now, obviously, with our hardened environments now, it's much easier to scan for those things. But back then, it was so slow, it almost feels like you were putting the compliance mindset over the actual security mindset. And that was something I learned really early on that I did not like too much.
Yeah, okay. Appreciate it. I feel like that, learning those things that you don't like or that really, the things not to do, the things you don't want to replicate, all that are just as important as, the things, those mental models you really want to latch onto and build.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, lots of good to learn in the public sector environment as well too, right? I mean, there's just a ton to take away in terms of the way people think about sharing information and controlling information flows and who's read into what scenarios. And there's just a whole bunch of good operational security side of things that the gov side does extremely well. But being nimble isn't always one of them.
So my deputy always used to say, like, you know, we're in the business of the government. And like, you know, it's not like a, you know, fail fast and break stuff kind of environment. Because
that's right.
There's real stuff that are bigger than pictures getting leaked or something that is on the other side of it.
That's right. Yep. Yep. And as long as if the programs are built in a way and funded in a way that allow for that change at the pace of what we're learning about the threat landscape and the attacker landscape, then that can work. That can still work really well.
I want to kind of use that, like, change at the pace that you need to change thing as the lead in here.
Yeah.
Because love that. Now, one of the big things I wanted to focus on today is how you see and how you are kind of navigating and working around this dynamic of, like, security as a traditional cost center in an organization. And how you are working towards simply enabling DO's strategy, mission, growth, customer trust, et cetera. Like, using security as a means as opposed to this kind of challenge. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you nailed it with the word customer in there. It's just about as getting as close to the customer with the security program as you possibly can. And there's going to be gradation in there, right? Even within an individual business and within a security program, there's going to be the stuff that no customer is ever going to really care about. So how well we do our user access reviews for SOX compliance, they really don't care. I mean, they want to know that we're a compliant business and that from a public company responsibility standpoint, we're doing what we need to do, but that's not going to change their mindset or their attitude about DigitalOcean as a business in the market. But what is are the security capabilities that are in front of them, some of the more public-facing compliance regimes that they need to be able to comply with in order to serve their customers. In my particular case, in the experience with DigitalOcean, the fraud and abuse and trust and safety side of the world was probably the first wedge that we built into bringing security out of this sort of like obscure cost center compliance area into something that was really, really meaningful for the business. Because a lot of the security capabilities that we built for fraud and abuse and trust and safety have an immediate impact on the customer experience, both potentially very good and also potentially very bad. There was one experience probably 18 months into my tenure at DO where we accidentally shut down a customer that had been part of our startup program called Hatch, and did it in a way that was not particularly customer friendly. It was a couple of big misses in terms of just human doing human things and a couple of errors that happened in that space, but it ended up being a fairly widely visible public event where I think the register headline was something along the lines of like DigitalOcean drowned my business. And that was, and it was a mistake in terms of some of the anti-crypto mining technologies we'd put in place, really to help our customers, because the more we could reduce the fraudulent crypto mining on the platform, the less problem we would have with something called noisy neighbor, which takes CPU cycles away from good customers because it's, you know, a bad customer on the same piece of hardware potentially mining against it. And that piece of automation and a couple of manual follow-ups later going rogue, you know, we were battling a pretty big PR situation. For better or for worse, those formative moments were really a piece of how we recognized just how important security was to the ability for us to grow and for our customers to grow in a safe and trusted way.
Yeah, I love that example. So when you refer to building this function, what does that mean in this context? Like, you know, how did you structure your team? Was there processes that you had where there's, and maybe even more importantly, who are the stakeholders, like your peers? Maybe it's HR, legal, sales. Who are the peers that were most important to you in facilitating that?
Yeah. I mean, so from a building the team standpoint, it was pretty close to ground up. I started at the same time as a peer of mine who is now the senior director of security operations. He's part of my overall security leadership team. He and I actually started on the same day. I came in as the director of security engineering. He was starting as director of security operations. There was a CISO at the time and about four other people on the team. It was really quite small for a cloud business. I mean, not entirely surprising given where the business was in terms of its arc, still relatively small, scrappy startup. But it was definitely the right time to get things moving in terms of a scaled security program that could cover all the various challenges of running a public cloud. And so, yeah, we started by pulling in the trust and safety team, which had been part of the support function, actually.
So it was an existing team.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Exactly. So there was a couple different teams. There was the trust and safety team, which was really just part of the support function. You know, we would get inbound complaints into our abuse inbox or legal ad inbox or other places where we would have high volumes of things are bad coming from your platform and you need to do something about it. And that was all just put through hands-on keyboard ticketing system in which our trust and safety teams were managing the problem with headcount, really. That's how they had scaled it. So we saw that, brought that into the fold, because really the trust of our platform and the outbound abuse from our platform is such a big component of how we're viewed and trusted amongst our customers and others on the internet. And so that's absolutely a major security component of our platform. The other thing that we did is stood up a dedicated engineering team. And I'm not talking about just like security engineering in the traditional sense of knowing security tools and technologies, but a team that could actually build software and code. Yeah. And so I think that's one of the things that we found to be very successful, is to be able to feed ourselves in terms of building and scaling automation for detections, and particularly again in that trust and safety and fraud and abuse space. We were able to own our own destiny by having the operations in one side and the engineering team on the other working closely together. That's not always perfect, but having those two teams next to one another has been huge in our ability to ship code, build automation, and do things at scale. I mean, we still run a fairly small ship when it comes to the number of headcount we have in the trust and safety, fraud and abuse, and security operations world. It's definitely enough to get the job done. We pretty much entirely scaled based on automation.
And I feel like that's one of those misnomer things in the industry right now. We use the term security engineer all the time. And I've found in most places that are not technology companies, basically what that ends up meaning is they're more like,
yes,
you know, from a security standpoint, you know, they're like,
yeah,
so, you know, one cluster setting up integrations and things like that, but they're not, and they might be like scripting is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a whole other rabbit hole that I may or may not want to go down today, maybe not. But you know, there's this like we talk about security people coding, and it's in many places synonymous with just basics.
Right.
And that is very, very, very different than like writing, maintaining, operating like enterprise software services.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly right. And I've found the same thing. The ability to, I don't know, run your Nessus environment, to be able to, you know, scan. There is an engineering skill set there, but it's not.
Yeah, it's different.
It is. It's just very, yeah, it's very different. And you're right. I mean, on the DigitalOcean security team, I mean, we run what we call like SEV1 services, meaning that if it were to go down, it would cause customer outage, customer visible outage.
Sorry, you got.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we are plugged into all of that. So like even our Vault cluster, I mean, you could sort of consider that to be some sys administration, but all of the stuff that sits around it to make it scalable and accessible and resilient, like multi-region deployments, load balanced reads out of the environment, even our we run our internal LDAP cluster as well. The entire identity system is a combination of LDAP and Okta, and how those two things communicate together and then scale out via deployments up to the production environment for access. Like those things all require actual building of services that are going to run and be scaled and not just do big IT sysadmin stuff. And so, you know, again, some of that's going to be customer visible, and then some of those things are just going to be internal. We got to keep it running, keep the lights on. Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that I think moved us away from just being viewed as an, you know, an internal shared services cost center kind of situation into something that's a lot more customer connective and viewed as critical to the success of our customers.
Yeah. So follow-on question to that is, security teams are normally, unless you're being on in some way, shape, or form, you're normally not seeing the customer visible to the customer. You know, there's no like bi-directional kind of visibility or communication that's happening. You know, that's probably being filtered through sales, customer support, or like other chats. So how did your team get plugged into those channels and like basically be able to start deriving insight instead of just, you know, assuming?
Yeah. I mean, we definitely connect with the customer on a regular basis. I mean, I probably talk to a customer once a week, and it's a couple different ways that we did that. You asked before about the stakeholders, and one is just building that relationship with the stakeholders, so internally, so they know what are the capabilities that we have when a customer comes and asks about something related to security. And then the second piece is just there are some unique things about running a public cloud where our security posture definitely does affect a customer directly.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like dealing with IP reputation issues, or, you know, maybe the customer is using our platform to do something that might get them blocked or something along those lines. Sometimes we have a lot of security companies that actually run on our platform and do testing off of our platform. We need to make sure that we're doing that safely. And so I think, you know, to your point about the stakeholder groups, you know, we've got marketing from the self-serve funnel standpoint, which is just, you know, how many, you know, we have 40, 50,000 customers that will sign up and start using our platform each month, and managing the influx of those customers and what they're doing and how they're using our platform, all the way down to the more, you know, white glove style customer engagement where we're working with a large customer who might be bringing a workload to our platform that they want to make sure is operating safely and isn't going to cause them or us issues. Yeah, I mean, that's a big piece of it. So I think a lot of it comes back to that customer buying criteria, which is that they care. If they care a lot about security when it comes to choosing their provider, that's when I've seen it, you know, work well to make sure that there's a conduit between the security team and, you know, we can try and train these folks in sales and CSMs to bring the right information to customers. But I found that it's hard, at least at our scale, to have that knowledge really well baked across the team. And the CSMs and the sales folks still definitely rely heavily on the group we have internally called Trust and Governance that helps bring the security messaging as part of the conversation to customers. So for example, if you go to digitalocean.com/security, we absolutely had help in marketing launching that, but all of the content, all of the thought process put into it, you know, what kind of messaging we wanted to structure, shared security responsibility model, all those things all came from the security team with the, you know, partnership with our marketing folks. But it wasn't the other way around of, you know, the marketing folks trying to just feel their way around in the dark sometimes when it comes to security. Unless, of course, you're a security products company, then you probably have that part pretty well figured out.
Yeah. Now, the other thing, so you guys have presumably grown past the, four to five people. Mark. So,
As
far as those internal relationships, how are you working with your team and getting other people to build bridges? You know, is it part of like their goals? Is it just kind of culture? That way, you know, everything's not riding on you, and you don't have a Tyler bus factor or Lotto factor to work on life.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's been actually part. It's both, really. It's actually something we have to continue to reinforce, but it's also part of the culture that we built when we started. Like I used to say that I wanted to build a relationship-based security team. That's just kind of how I would frame it to the folks on our team and to the other stakeholders that would work in the base business, is because after spending a lot of time in different sizes and shapes and styles of businesses and in the public sector space too, learned that you cannot do security alone. Everybody says security is a team sport. I know that's probably a something that's been used, way overused at this point, but it is true. But I definitely knew heading into this that it had to be a relationship-based security team. And so just spent a ton of time figuring out how to make the other stakeholders successful in what they want to go do. And so for, you know, our marketing team, they are incentivized to bring more and more and more and more customers onto the platform, which makes it difficult for our capacity team when the capacity team is responsible for making sure that our hypervisors are available and clean and free for good customers who want to come use them. And sometimes those two things were at odds with one another, with security kind of right in the middle. And so figuring out how to make both groups successful, how to measure it and how to prove it to them that their lives have gotten better over time because we've done things like, you know, put good fraud detections in the sign-up funnel in place or built more advanced crypto mining detections to help get bad workloads off of the hypervisors faster. I think it was figuring out and pinpointing where each one of those teams was, like how they were motivated and making them successful in their goal, which in turn made us successful in what we wanted to accomplish.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And so one thing that I ran into a lot was there were silos. Like there was always silos in one organization. And one of the ways that we pursued breaking down those silos was really trying to make sure the teams were, that we found points of alignment between teams. So it's kind of reinforcing this. Everyone has to collaborate with everyone. We're going to run a flat organization, you know, whatever, as was culture, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
You know, which had to be really intentional. Just the flows of like the, you know, call it value streams, call it whatever, where people, where there were real points of necessary points. And, you know, and that within our team, but then outside stakeholders where there was handoffs, like incident management was like good. Example of that is, you know, there's operations, there's us, there's privacy, there's potentially a general counsel. In our case, we have the Office of Legislation.
And right.
They were the ones doing Congress. And then we have the Chief Operating kind of Administrator's Office where the political sat. And so there was, like, we really had to be intentional around ironing out this kind of like flows where people were intentionally collaborative. And
yeah,
then at the point of like two teams interacting with one another, figure out what the best way to service were so that way.
Yep.
And so as the long-winded way of like backing into a question here with that context of is, do you find that there are certain teams or departments or functions where it is easier to find the alignment of incentives over others?
Wow. Yeah, that's good context and a great question in terms of like thinking through
that.
No, it's the organizational dynamics. Absolutely. And I mean, there are moments when it's got to be process driven. I think especially in incidents or other circumstances where, you know, there's not a lot of room for error or miscommunication. Like you want that to be process driven. And then there are other pieces where you really want it to be, you know, finding that common ground more naturally and aligning these incentives in the right way. So I'll give you an example is like the security design review process that we have in place. When a team wants to bring a new product to market.
Of a new thing.
Yeah. So like, you know, just product design lifecycle stuff where like from the very inception, I guess it's really at this stage where we're, you know, proving out potentially a technical architecture. They're doing an RFC on a new architecture, a new product. There's security engagement across that entire lifespan from when we start thinking about what a product should look like and how we'll integrate for customers through the point in time where we're delivering it and potentially testing it as it's going live. That's pretty intentional. Like, we try not to use a lot of room for error in that one. We still have to make prioritization decisions. We don't have a large enough product security team to do every single nook and cranny feature that might be coming through the development pipeline. But a lot of the big stuff, we want to make sure that we're doing what we need to do to launch a secure and safe product for our customers. And we don't want to miss those steps. And I got to be honest, it really is dependent on the team. Sometimes it feels like we are forcing their hand to come engage with us. And we don't like that. We don't want that to be the case. We want it to all be heavily collaborative. And to your point that you said before, like the words of a CISO or somebody else rattling around in their heads to say, let's make sure that we're launching this thing safely. So let's go talk to security. But it is highly dependent. I've found that our partnership with marketing is actually incredibly strong, which is, I think, not what you might expect or kind of unique, but that happens to be one of the strongest ones that we have. And then certainly in like the infrastructure space. But I think that the further we go up stack and you start to think about the further abstractions away from infrastructure where teams are doing more heavily just like software releases that don't really necessarily have hypervisor or capacity impact, it's easier for teams to forget that a lot of the primitives that they're looking at in building still need to dive back to the right auth and auth z capacity considerations, limits considerations, like how much we want someone to be able to deploy, even if it's something that we consider to be fairly safe. You still don't want to run out of capacity at any point in time. So yeah, so I think that's probably, if I had to pinpoint it, is where the further that we were going up stack, the more we have to make sure it's super intentional to engage.
Okay.
But we definitely have tight relationships across legal, finance. I mean, you know, a lot of the considerations for privacy all flow back through those organizations. And to me, that just feels like we're always locking arms to come up with the right solution.
Love that. Okay. Now I'm gonna dig into the product security thing a little bit.
Yeah.
Have you ever listened to any threat model talks by Jivan Singh? By chance?
The name doesn't ring a bell. No, I haven't. I don't believe. Yeah.
So he used to run security engineering and threat modeling team segment, which was then bought by Twilio.
Yep.
He's over at Ripple.
Got it.
Friend of mine for a while now. He's been in the OWASP community.
Nice.
And one of the things that he pushes, and others like Adam Shostak and other folks far smarter than me have kind of championed this, is this idea of like the developer-led threat modeling or developer-led security design.
Yes.
And this is something like back when I was at Cigital, this was a big kind of hotly contested topic of like how much lives out in the developer space where they are empowered through tools, like maybe it's secure templates or libraries or
documentation
and things like that, training. And how much is run in-house and, you know, kind of delivered in this, like, as a service. And because, you know, just that decision represents a huge, like, those are very different things. And if you wanted to say, like, all right, we're going to start doing security architecture work as a security team, you're kind of, like, stepping into this, like, bifurcation of, like, all right, what direction are we going to go? Are we going to enable teams to do it? Are we going to do it ourselves? Or are we going to kind of have a foot in both and maybe like do it ourselves on mission critical stuff and enable teams to do it themselves so it's more scalable? And so curious, like when that product development dynamic you mentioned, how do you guys think about enabling? And maybe it's like beyond security design, because that's just one part of product security. You know, you've also got the static analysis, the SASH, the DAS, the SCA. Throw all the acronym soup at it. Like, so how do you guys think about like enabling those teams without having to be like stretching your product security teams so thin?
Yes, that is, I feel like a perennial challenge for every security organization. Yeah, one of the things that we've done is we definitely have like the secure by design guidance that everyone can find. So we have a portal, an internal portal that's focused on engineering templates, if you will. I mean, it's just like a lot of like, what are the paved paths for engineering? And we have a security portion of that. So for things like all of our internal service, all of our services use MTLS. So they're mutually authenticated across each other. And, you know, that uses taps into Vault and our Vault architecture. So we have some really well paved paths on how to go do that. And so we don't need to have a product security engineer sitting there with someone who's building a new service to say, like, here's how you talk to and communicate to all the other services, the environment, because it's all right there. Same thing with a lot of the LDAP and role creation and you know, various app roles and that kind of thing. And so what we try to do is push as much as possible into those paved paths. I mean, we just have a security engineering baseline document that says, here are the, I forget how many categories, it's between 5 and 10 categories, where it just says, if you're doing these things and your feature is, you know, approximately about this size, you can probably start working on it and making sure that you're covering these areas. You know, you could create a security design review, but we're likely to deprioritize it against something that's a much more complex launch. So we try to give our engineers as much self-service as possible in that space, and then figure out where we want to invest from there. So a great example of that is we recently launched something called RBAC standard roles. So now on our platform, we have a set of 5 or 6 standard roles rather than the super complex custom roles, which we are building for some customer use cases. But we know that the majority of customer use cases, everyone has the same mindset in terms of like what they want the folks on their team to be able to do from a CRUD operation standpoint against the environment, and said, all right, let's be really opinionated about the standard roles that we want to bring forward. We dedicated some serious product security engineering time into that space because it's business logic. And I think that's where we generally want our product security team to be spending a lot of time, is when from a threat modeling standpoint, it's the business logic that is most exploitable that we want to spend a lot of time thinking through it.
Yeah.
It also maximizes the brain power and the engagement of those teams, because if they're just kind of going through doing the product security, if they're just doing more of the checklist stuff, like that's not great time spent. We want them really thinking hard about what the business problem is, how the customer is engaging with it, what the threat model looks like when it potentially becomes exploitable, and what are all those corner case business logic things that can come up that might bite us down the line, and that often are the hardest to discover once something is launched.
Yes. Yeah. Business law. I feel like, you know, even doing something like a penetration test, like that's always where the most interesting stuff is. Maybe you have like complicated kind of training scenarios and whatnot that you can work through, but like, the business law, you know, it's good. Like, I remember years ago when I was at Sigital, we were working for a financial services company, customer of ours, and they were launching this big product, and there was a really subtle bug. You know, they had a few like vulnerabilities, like username relation, registering account without email verification, stuff like that. And it was like, okay, those are normally like low risk issues, etc.
Yep.
But there was something that you could do. You could inject this, you could like tamper with this one parameter, sign up for.
Mm-hmm.
Would basically corrupt the user in their back end, like user tape. And they couldn't, like, somebody had to like manually go in and like unscrew this thing to fix it. And so, and like this thing, we kind of worked out this scenario where you could imagine like just signing up for a whole bunch of accounts without their email verification, basically detecting all of them, where their customer service team can't launch this product successfully. And it was like, you know, we're like working on the security team initially on like these low risk issues. And they're like, what app doesn't have these kind of things?
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of like work you crescendo your way towards the like, oh, this is like what it could mean.
Yes.
We don't like that.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a great example. I mean, we have one recently that's now fixed, but I think it was probably, I forget if we did the root cause for how long it had been a bug, but speaking of email verification, I mean, there was a bug that was allowing customers to, upon registration, essentially send themselves 2 email verifications. And if you didn't click the first link first and you changed your email address and then redid the email verification, it would, you know, you'd basically then have two confirm your emails and two different inboxes, one of which you might not even own, or even it might not even be a real email address. But if you've changed it and then resent the verification before you completed the signup stage and then clicked the confirm on the first one that you sent, it would actually confirm your email for the second.
You're kind of loose condition.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's one of those things where it's not a major bug, but it certainly was something that we wanted to get fixed as fast as possible because it was being exploited. People, we could see signups that were attached to email addresses that were like, that company is not on our platform. That doesn't look legit. And so we had a bunch of weird email addresses coming through the signup funnel that didn't really make sense to us. And it took a while to dig into this and eventually found that fraudsters who were keen on trying to make it past our fraud mitigation components were manipulating their email signup through the signup flow, which is pretty wild.
That's one like little bit of signal that you have in that whole.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, I want to ask one more question about this, like this kind of internal page road.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to connect the two, like, you know, some of the work that you were talking about with your marketing team and that. Now, do you find that? Well, all right. So, one of the things that I think is such an underrated set of skills is this whole idea of effective communication, storytelling, salesmanship, which is, you know, an icky word in the field. But effectively, you know, you are presenting and kind of evangelizing, you know, security inside the organization because security, the rule of it is not often the security team.
Exactly.
And so you find that, like, when your team is working with getting and kind of seeing how they do things, what they do, how they approach it, that there's a reciprocal benefit on how you guys engage and show up and evangelize internally.
Wow. Interesting. I think subtly, yes. I mean, I think that we oftentimes try to learn from marketing and our product managers. But I also would say that is something that I believe in so strongly. And so it's also something that I'm kind of asking my leaders to always think about. Again, in that relationship-based security mode, it requires changing the mindset away from, you know, luckily we didn't have this problem with DO, but the security being a team of no, right? I mean, that's historically been a challenge and one that I wanted to make sure we addressed right at the outset of building the team. And so I had a lot of leaders who have been super helpful and effective in doing that. In fact, Tim Lisko and Ari Kalfas, who are in our security engineering team, they presented at OWASP this time last year of exactly that, of like security team enabling their organization, not being a department of no. I forget the exact name of their talk, but something along those lines. It was fantastic. It was really cool to see them get up there and not even just evangelize within DO, but out to the broader community about how we connect with our peers across the business. And so it's very intentional. And I feel like it has to be. It's not one of those things that comes naturally to a lot of us who come from the security side of things. It's easy to be negative or super risk averse to the point of being difficult to engage with. Like, there are a lot of pitfalls that come with having a security mindset. And if you can break yourself free of those in the right moments, still have them and still have that be your core ethos, but like break yourself free of those in the right moments to communicate effectively, I think is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I think one other dynamic that I observe over my own career is I think our field has, I think this is slowly moving in a positive direction, but I feel like for the longest time we prized this somewhat abrasive rock star culture, you know, but you know, the DEFCON, like, you know, drop 0 days, shame everyone for not being security, you know, kind of thing.
Yep.
And I think those folks got put on pedestals, and that's what people aspired towards, was this, you know, this kind of very technical but somewhat standoffish,
yep,
egotistical like personality. And I feel like in this security culture that you're trying to build. You can't have the abusive, hostile, standoffish security culture because nobody wants to work with
it. No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there's still a ton of value in the folks who can do what you just described, which is come up with something so esoteric that they can be like that. It does take like a certain kind of person. It's not me. Like I'll be the first one to say it. Like I don't have that. Like I love to break things, but there's a certain limit that I'll be able to get to in terms of my level of dedication in breaking something that some people just have the ability to surpass, and that they're going to figure out the most esoteric thing. It's wild, right? And so there's still value in that, but it does take, in order for the rest of the world and the rest of our companies to get that value, it has to be presented to them in a way that they can consume it.
Yes.
And so I think that everybody has those roles there. And so I think we do still have a couple folks within the security team that I would say lean more towards that OG security mentality, which is totally cool. And I love talking with them, and especially in like one-on-one settings and just getting them going about whatever various topic it may be. But there is a bit of a ceiling, at least from I wouldn't say a technical leadership, but from like an organizational leadership standpoint, because eventually you'll run into areas where you're not able to connect with someone to get the outcome that you want.
Right. Well, and in the CISO role, whatever it is, like that.
Yeah.
Organizational kind of on the organizational ladder, so much of your work is not technical, not even strategy. It's strategy and technical, but it's very relational. It's very it's all that other stuff. It's kind of like I liken it to like a yin and a yang.
It is
skills that we need to be investing in. I mean, we do conferences and trainings and all of that are just dominant technical content, which is super important. But if you're operating at like 100% and 50% and like 10% of the other 50%, then you put them all together and it's not that impressive. But if you're
right.
A little less technical, but you're an amazing communicator, friendly, approachable, you're reasonable.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, when I'm looking at, future leaders for DigitalOcean security space, I mean, it's the folks who do both well. I mean, I still really believe that the technical side of things is a must. It has to be, but you have to have that balance. It's like you said, yin and yang. It's like it is a balance. And I think like anything else in life, that striking the right balance is the right way to find success. I mean, to over rotate in there's arguments to be made, like you said, like a rock star mentality, right? Being an incredible guitarist or whatever it might be that just, vaults you into the Hall of Fame. Like if that can be a goal, that can be an outcome, but you have to be incredible. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly, there's no room for not being in the top 10 of whatever that field might be that you're talking about. And then the rest, what success can look like is much more of striking the right balance and figuring out how to make others around you successful rather than bringing them down.
Yep. I totally agree. Now, speaking of relationships, so Diem is a publicly traded company. So you're dealing with all the, foreign SEC rules and guidelines. All the hubbub about the rules changes and whatnot. I guess it wasn't recent, relatively recently, at least in near-term memory, especially around breach notification, incident management, breach notification, important materials. Now, what was it like for you? Maybe for you and then some of your direct reports that involved in this process to iron out and kind of like the communication side of incident management? Because I guess backdrop is incident management is one of the things that we're looking at CMS. as it does in most security organizations. And there is like what I observed was like there's a lot of like very strong technical proficiency in terms of digging a ransomware or doing log analysis, whatever. And then as soon as something had to like, you know, kind of flip from this very technical thing into a more polished executive product that would go in front of Congress, it's felt like that, you know, my kids building, like my 4-year-old, like kind of assembling, you know, his like makeshift car versus like, you know, building like one of these like Technic sets that's like super glued together and like ready to go out, you know, down a track or something. And it's like, one of them's going to fall apart relatively quickly, and the other one is going to hold up a little, you know, as it goes through the show. And so, you know, curious, like what that process was like for you specifically. I'm like a non-technical person.
Yeah. I mean, good news is that we had a lot in place already. I think that the relationship that I have with the audit committee and kind of some of the established patterns we have around incident reporting. So we had a security incident response process that during a major incident, we have a couple of different criteria. Like if we'd ever need to write out to customers, you know, if something along the lines of GDPR notifications or other situations where it would be customer visible or potentially hit PR, you know, gradation between various incidents. But ultimately, it would result in, me putting a fairly formal communication forward to the audit committee during that incident response process. Generally, it would hit the end of the containment phase of our incident response process to do that communication, because that's also when we line up with our GDPR 72-hour reporting window timeframe starting. And so we at least had that paved path of, you know, me up through audit committee board level to start, which I think if any organizations don't have that, even if you are not a public company, I would like, that's the first, get used to that and build that relationship and build that bridge, because it's obviously an incredibly important one. And so we already had that. And then what we needed to do was just build out what we had as our materiality scoping committee. And so we worked with legal, we worked with internal audit, worked with finance to figure out, I mean, we already have a materiality threshold when it comes to us as a business overall. It was more about how do we know whether a security incident is reaching a level of materiality?
I was going to ask about that.
Massive gray area. Yeah.
Huge. That's exactly right. Like very much not a prescriptive thing. And no. I guess more should.
Right.
So there's all the talk about risk quantification and loss modeling and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then there's more of this like criteria based.
Yeah. We did a combination of both ultimately. Yeah. So we've got a workbook that we put together. It's technically owned by legal, but then it's signed off by myself and our general counsel after we've gone through a materiality assessment. It's about 10 different criteria. Fairly high level, just to get to that documented point in time where we say we believe this is material or not. And we say our process can go back and change that, because sometimes you learn something much later that is different, then we go back and change it. But what we did is we built that out, built out a process, had outside counsel look at it, and then tabletopped it like 2 or 3 times. Wow. And just, through about this time last year through December, we ran 2 or 3 different scenarios, some of them based in real things that had happened to DigitalOcean previously, to come up with how we would have assessed materiality. And we've used it once or twice in live fire scenarios since December. Both of them were not even close to material, but we were doing it for good diligence anyway, just to make sure we had it. Yeah, so I'd say, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So we've done it probably 5 times in total between tabletop exercises and real live fire incidents.
Okay. Now, last episode, I talked with Joe Lewis, who's the CISO of CDC.
Yep.
And one of the things that he experiences this, I experienced this, was in the public sector, and I'm sure you did as well when you were in the defense force, is financial impact is not really as an,
right?
You know, you have these CMS is a $1 trillion organization. It's like the collective. Yeah. It's like 1.4 trillion.
Oh my goodness.
That's program money, of course, but like, but still, it's just like, you know, you come in and start talking to somebody about a $5 million risk if you try to like quantify it. And it's like, you know, at that level, it's still such a rounded in.
Right.
And it's not to like be reckless about any kind of loss, but it's just not, it's not at on the same level. And so you end up instead shifting your conversation to talk about more qualitative things like mission
impact. Yeah.
Or
yes,
mission impact, you may be able to quantify the impact of students and, you know, or the reputational harm. In our case, it's the Washington Post gonna, you know, write an article
right
about something? Is Congress gonna inquire about something? You know, those kind of things got people's attention more.
Got it.
And so I'm curious, you know, like, given your relationship with marketing, you all have that mission that's related to stuff your customers are building on top. And then
right,
you've got your own company's mission. So, the material assessment is good for, you know, obviously abiding by regulatory requirements and such. But as part of your incident response process, do you bring in those other types of risk? And if so, how do you go?
Yeah, we do. And I'm forgetting exactly how we have it framed in our materiality assessment, but it's something along the lines of, do we think that we will lose X number of top customers, or are we at risk, and what percentage of that risk? You know, is there a 50% chance we're going to lose our top 20 customers over something like this?
Yeah.
Because we have an enormous long tail of customers, right? So it's like 600,000 plus customers on DO at any given time who are active. You know, just it's a really broad scope, but really the focal point for us in terms of materiality determination is really that top 5-10% of customers, or even like 2.5-5%. Because, you know, if you're running your personal Minecraft server on DO, it's like, we love you, but like, we're probably not considering you as material to our business if you happen to leave.
Yeah.
But, you know, someone who's running a mission critical business on top of us, that if they left would be material, you know, potentially a large customer loss. It does tie back to that revenue loss standpoint. So we do still bring it back there, but there's that reputational impact too, right? Which is future revenue growth. So there's existing revenue churn, but then also the potential impact of future revenue growth absolutely is a part of the equation. And so we definitely talk about it from the customer lens and standpoint. Like, if I was a customer DO, how would I view this? How would I guide my business? If I was a CISO in a different business looking at DO, how would I view this particular incident when I found it, you know, on X or wherever else that it might have popped up in terms of PR? So that is part of the equation, not the easiest to quantify in terms of our assessment, but I think a really big part of it.
Yeah, something subjective, but still, you know, kind of a directive.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Out of curiosity, have you ever gone through the process? I don't know if anything like this exists, if you're having like an advisory board like resource of maybe it's customers or, you know, maybe, yeah, peers to like look at an incident, even if it's a mock, like hypothetical incident, table time, and, you know, get their take whether or not they're like, let's say they were going to decision makers,
right,
to get their sense of like how you're calibrated versus the actual outside perspective.
Yeah, I don't think that we've done that specific to security incidents. We definitely think about that from a overall resiliency standpoint. And that's another really interesting gray area on the SEC guidance, because I'm pretty sure availability is stated in their guidance around reporting materiality. And of course, if we had something that, you know, took a data center offline for X number of days or hours or whatever it may be, we would report that regardless. But it's really interesting to think about it from that standpoint, because, you know, what if there's an undersea cable cut that forces a bunch of rerouting that creates a bunch of latency for our customers in Europe? I don't know, just made that up. Definitely an availability impact that we have to think about, that our customers are concerned about, because all of a sudden, you know, we're looking at a ton of latency that might be impacting those customers' business. But is that an SEC reportable event? I mean, it's an undersea cable cut. Like, I don't, like, that There's a very interesting gray area, but yeah, I mean, to the question about customer advisory, certainly on the availability and resiliency side, I've thought about pulling together kind of an advisory board on the security side as well. But yeah, I think that the availability gray area is an interesting one on the guidance.
I feel like availability is, when you're in school, if you're, you know, take any kind of like security course, you know, everyone will hammers down the
triad. Oh yeah.
But it's not in the real world, and availability is like,
yeah,
one of these situations. And, you know, it's I think one of the more interesting elements of the triad in the sense that it has, I think, the most, well, integrity. I'd say if I had to rank them, it would go availability, integrity, confidentiality in terms of like having the potential for cascading failures.
Yes.
Availability is obviously, I think, is a little more obvious. It's something's down, something else that's relying on it. It's integrity.
Yep.
Is a little subtle. Has the potential. And I think, like, you know, you look at like the SEC guidelines, and if it was very focused on your organization, not necessarily the ecosystem of organizations, your shirt.
Right. Yeah. What is your take? Is availability that is not related to outside threat actor, is that a security issue?
I'll ask the questions here, sir.
I think that's
a really interesting. It's a really interesting question. I would say
it's not necessarily a security issue, but I think it's something that you would maybe want to report or at least disclose,
yeah, if nothing else, from the standpoint of what is your organization's business continuity plan look like in relation to its downstream kind of supply.
Right.
Yeah. And I was actually going to ask you about this next is, like, you know, thinking about your, you know, so Dudo is a third party to many other organizations.
Right.
Your third parties, though, how, like, they factor into your incident response process? Because I think this is also, this is one of those areas where it's so easy. I mean, I wasn't doing this intentionally, but wearing the Spider-Man shirt. Pointing at each other, like, this is like one of those classic like whodunit type scenarios where everyone's just like blaming everyone else, and it's, you know, it's so easy to just like cast away blame in a third party, you know, kind of third party failure scenario. And my personal sense is organizations need to kind of own and have like full accountability around like their operating processes.
Yes,
in relation to their supply. So like.
Completely agreed.
Like, if you know, if you're using a tool, you own the configuration and all that tool. You own monitoring and setup and the use of the tool. If it's something you're reliant on, you should be factoring that into your BCP and all that to like make sure that if that thing goes down, you might, like, you know, in our world, it was to change after a breach.
Right.
Ended up creating all these cascading failures and, like, you know, kind of highlighting it, underscored how poor business continuity planning / was for so much of the sector. And
yeah.
Because like this supplier was unavailable. And even when the supplier started to come back up, there's all these business processes that were tied into it, had these relatively tough pipelines to that supplier. And that caused all these failures. And that, I think, it's just such an interesting case study to be thinking about, like, how your organization really manages itself in relations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for us, it's exactly what you said. Like, there is no excuse. A supplier could go down and we have to have a plan for it. Yeah. I mean, there's just no, our customers won't care. They don't care if it's a RAM issue that made a bunch of hypervisors die, or if it's an undersea cable cut, or, you know, if Cloudflare was down. Like, there are dozens of or that they just don't care about. They want their service to work with us and us to be reliable for their business. So we absolutely treat it that way from a shared responsibility model standpoint. Where it gets really interesting is from a security standpoint. One of the examples I've been using recently to talk about potentially requiring two-factor authentication for all customers which I'm a big proponent of, but I know it can be a challenge to implement depending on, especially if you're in a heavily, you know, business to consumer environment, where a little bit of both B2B and B2C, but it's something I'm thinking about very seriously, is the whole situation with Snowflake over the summer.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
You know, in relation to secure by design, but also in relation to what third-party risk management should really look like as,
exactly,
as a CISO. And there's two really meaty things to but speaking of, like, 2FA, there's, because, you know, like, you guys operate publicly. So, like, there's a zillion and one bells and whistles that you can kind of turn on and off and tune and all that stuff.
Yep.
And yeah, like having a kind of default, you know, same deal with like the internal paved road experiences for the engineers. Like, what is the paved road
for customers?
Out of the box, for experience, like,
exactly. Exactly.
How do you build that? Because, you know, customers, like anyone, are likely going to take the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
And the Snowflake thing, it's like, Snowflake probably carried some, I think they do carry some blame. In the sense that, like, that wasn't a mandatory feature. It's like,
right,
AWS allowing public S3 buckets by default for the longest time, and like all these people just getting burned. Like, sure, you know, they carry a lot of blame, but ultimately, you know, it's really on the shoulders of the.
Yeah. At the same time, though, and I think this is kind of the message that I was driving home, even with our leadership team, is nobody cares that it wasn't Snowflake's fault necessarily. It's still the fact that they, you know, were in this place where a bunch of their customers were going through a pretty hectic security time, and they were the epicenter of that, regardless of whether or not it was explicitly their fault. And that's,
and they could have done something.
Yeah, they didn't.
Yeah, and
exactly.
Shame them or whatever. But
no,
it's a good lesson to, you're like, we as an organization can be thinking about security meets user experience, meets, you know, product goals, what the outcome somebody's trying to,
yes,
do. You know,
yeah,
how do we approach that? Because, like, oftentimes you have to buy into security features and, you know, enterprise version, you're upselling and all that. And both businesses are like, I don't want, you know, I'm not, you know, 5x-ing my cost on this tool. Like, get out of here with your SAML tax.
Yeah, I was just going to say the SSO tax is one of the funniest ones, which I.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting because at least in our circumstance, there's a very large dependence on the shared responsibility model, because we can put as many things in front of our customers as we can. And I want to do more. I think that's one area that DigitalOcean has some room to go, which is to getting really novel security capabilities into the hands of our customers natively on the platform is a goal of mine. But, you know, at the same time, a customer can show up and ignore the fact that we highly recommend and even put it in the user interface to use key-based auth for Droplet and pop in a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 password, and that Droplet's going to get, that instance is going to get compromised within minutes of being on public-facing internet, literally minutes, and then start dousing outbound or phishing or whatever it may, you know, bad actors are going to do with it. We can't prevent all of them, but as long as we're making that you brought the paid path again, like, that's exactly it. Just making it as user friendly and simple as possible to do the right thing for security. That's the most we can do. Yeah.
That message really transcends, like, internal, external.
Yes.
Personal. So, like, kind of zooming in, or, like, you know, out of a work setting, for a little while, they bought a family version of, like, 1Password.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, 1Password is fantastic, but I think it's a little more advanced than a lot of, like, non-technical people are really willing to kind of, you know, secret keys. It's like it's a little harder to just, like, get signed in on multiple accounts and just go. And, you know, if you're a non-technical user, and, you know, I struggled to get my household, you know, right, you know, like, rally to run on using a trip until I changed to something that was a little more, like, user friendly and still was upgrading security, but they weren't using it, because the usability drove the overall value that thing was able to provide.
And yep.
See that same dynamic very much existing.
Oh yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, knowing your employees, knowing your customers, knowing what they need to be successful with is enormous. I mean, a lot of people talk about like heavy MDM solutions on phones, and that we found that that's not even that particularly good in most settings. And it is in a lot of circumstances, especially gov. I think it's highly important, but there are a lot of private company work settings where, you know, having two phones doesn't really make sense anymore. I mean, the zero trust architectures, I suppose, if we want to throw around some buzzwords, have helped us get past that to a large degree, which is great. But like, yeah, I think that's exactly it. You have to know your customer. You have to know exactly what they need to be able to be successful. I think having a highly technical business within DigitalOcean has made us really successful in some circumstances, and actually kind of difficult in others, because we have some like Linux power users who are like, screw you, I don't want to have anything else running on my endpoint in terms of
EDR out of here.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know that's the same for customers too, right? So if I'm thinking about, you know, we're an all Linux cloud, you know, it's something that I would love to be able to offer to customers in terms of a simple and low operational expense and complexity security for a Linux platform that would allow them to quickly define and deploy what they want and just kind of get it out of the way. And the biggest problem is that, yeah, there hasn't been much of that in the market historically. I think it's getting a lot better. There are a few things that I've seen that have popped up recently, but like, it's just not been a market historically.
Yeah, I totally agree. Which then, like, you know, pushes you into a situation of like, is there even an option to build or buy? And like, where do we kind of fall on that spectrum? And yeah, because if you're about to scale, that would be a very potentially large vibes.
Right.
Because yes, that's something we're going to want. But competitive landscape. Company trying to like build a FedRAMP ready application or some mission critical thing that has all these compliance requirements and like most of the time in a compliance ecosystem, at least from what I've observed, you've got, you know, your user workstations, the server environment is just, you know, like the Wild West. Like that's we monitor it, we do configuration like CSPM stuff, but beyond that, it's like, you know, server endpoints are kind of neglected from like an asset protection standpoint. I could see that tension around that decision data.
It is, yeah, and I think it's an interesting one because will just throw a CIS benchmark on a you know instance and say, oh, it's done. But like, yeah, I think that there's a more to go in this space, and what I try to imagine is how to make it as simple and as integrated and opinionated as possible. Because at least for a lot of our customers, they may not even have a security team or a large security team or someone who's even dedicated to thinking about securing the infrastructure. I'm sure they probably have that responsibility internally, but they might not have a CISO with a CISO team. Some of them do, but a lot of them, especially in their early stages, don't. And so how do you create nor should they, yeah, because it's going to be distracting from innovating on whatever they're innovating on, and they'll never make it to market if they're just going to only focus on security of the infrastructure that they're building.
Yep.
So the more we can abstract away those complexities and do the thinking on our own first and then put it in front of them in an opinion-weighted way, the better. But that's a tough nut to crack. And I think we're always thinking about that as we're bringing new products to market. Like, what are those security primitives that we can come built in?
Yeah. And I love the thinking that I love the term opinionated in this discussion, because that is, I think when you start to shift away from being normal, and it, like, you end up with just so much variance that you need to then manage, and that variability is complexity. End up either biting you long term, or it's just something that is just kind of like you have to be hands off and just not manage it. And that then represents some amount of like residual risk.
It does. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can configure just about any security technology out there to be so noisy that it becomes useless. And so And then you can also do nothing with it, and therefore it's not representing any risk mitigation. So I think that there is somewhere in between that allows us to say, for these large bulk of use cases, that we're able to do something that is reasonable and makes sense, provides the reasonable level of assurance. It's never going to necessarily be perfect, but I think that in the circumstances, especially with a fast-growing technology company building in cloud infrastructure, perfect isn't the answer. It's something is better than nothing in many circumstances.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I feel like our field, like the tagline for our field on some level, or like what I want to see pushed into like university settings, is like, don't let perfect be good.
100%. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I've got to do this thing, but like early in my career, especially when I was coming from consulting, like I was so like drinking the Kool-Aid. I wanted things to be like really secure.
Yes.
So in that, made so many just wild, stupid decisions. And it's, you know, and it's unfortunate. And I feel like now with time and grading and, you know, kind of less emotional attachment to these things, I can see them for what they were and grown from them, learn from them. But I think that is such a, it's such a prevalent tendency. And thinking about that,
yes,
condition work, in fact, really, to really want to make sure that something is pure, not like good enough or better.
Yeah.
And that's a hard pill to swallow.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, it's the old conversation of like, of course, it would be great to have everything be unhackable. But we know that that's not how it works, and that can't be the goal. It's all about making sure that it's economics, right? The time investment put in should be you know, right, difficult enough, yeah, and commensurate with the value at risk. I mean, yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's kind of funny reflecting on that. I feel like I've become, I wouldn't say more risk acceptance. I don't think it's that. It's just better identifying when to really lean in on those moments of like mitigating or removing risk, and when not to. I think it's, to your point, it's just like, you would expect someone who spends more time in security to become more and more and more and more paranoid. But I've actually found myself being like, oh no, I've seen that a dozen times. It's really never not gonna bite us. Like, let's not worry about that as much.
Yeah. Or if it does, it's not, you know, we've got a path forward.
We've got a path. Exactly. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Well, I want to ask you one last question. Now, thinking about this whole security as an enablement factor to transformation, to growth, to turnarounds, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like, what if somebody was stepping into a new role, or maybe, you know, you yourself in the future stepping into a new role, and that's the scenario What's the one big thing you would recommend to that person in terms of like making sure that security is a part of that transformation story and not just, you know, kind of the distractor?
Yeah. It's probably going to sound somewhat cliche, but it's just true. Just figure out how the business makes money.
That's not cliche at all. I love that, because I think it's something that's never talked about. Like,
yeah,
my deputy, and you're like, all the power to him, he's amazing, he's still amazing in the role that he was in. He had spent so much time at CMS, and he had this presentation and, you know, like this kind of organization of like how she was,
yeah,
different centers, what they did, how data flowed, all that stuff. And you know, you can't really function effectively in your job if you don't know how what's happening around you.
Yeah.
Supposed to work, like, how,
yeah,
the strategy based on, you know, is it based on like mixing growth in users, or based on marketing?
Exactly.
Know,
exactly. Yeah.
You know, what's the conversion kind of acquisition process, all that stuff. And then you can kind of like figure out where to, you know, you've got a bundle of sticks that you can, you know, kind of spend on security.
Yeah. Right. That's exactly it. I mean, we talked about before the idea of incentives of your stakeholders, like who are the main stakeholders and how are they incentivized? And at the top level, what are the customers doing and how are they incentivized to engage with the business, which ultimately means how you're making money. So I was kind of saying that tongue in cheek. There's a lot of different like nuances to that piece of it, but it's really like, why do the customers care about the security program and how would they potentially view it? So, you know, for example, like you don't necessarily want to show up to a life sciences business and say, all right, we got to do PCI compliance. And obviously, hopefully no CISO would actually go do that, but it's like, unless you're collecting credit card data, like probably going the wrong direction with that particular path. So it's like, you think you have to really leave behind all the preconceived notions of wherever you've come from. And say, you know, use those learnings and experiences to guide your team and your thought process. But the first question, and really opening your ears to after you've asked the question, is, you know, how are we making money? Why do our customers care?
Yep. And I like asterisk that with anyone who's in a nonprofit or a mission style organization. how does the mission work?
Right.
Why do you exist?
Exactly.
Yeah, because if you don't understand that, you're gonna be a fun slot.
It'll be tough sledding for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for the time.
Of course,
thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, likewise.
I hope that we get a chance to.
Yeah, for sure. No, thanks for having me on, Robert. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you, everyone.